using string theory to motivate the particular a particular example of ADS-CFT, namely the one that involves n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory in 3 plus 1 dimensions, and on the other side, type 2b, string theory in ADS Watson's S5. And the basic idea was we put a whole bunch of D3 brains somewhere on top of each other. And in this picture I'm drawing the three brains at a point. I'm suppressing the directions that go along the D3 brains, and I'm drawing only the dimensions transverse to them, of which there are six, because D3 brains are 3 plus 1 dimensional, and they live in 10 dimensions. And by looking at a neighborhood of these D3 brains and thinking about what it looks like at weak coupling and at strong coupling and comparing those two, we derived by subtraction the statement of ADS-CFT. And notice that, so the reason that there's an S5 involved in this duality is that the set of points an equal distance away from a point in R6 is an S5. And so something that you had to say that might be that you might notice based on this is that you could imagine deriving many, many other examples of the correspondence in this kind of way, either by thinking about other kinds of brains. You know, string theory comes with a large zoology of kinds of extended objects, like N-theory brains and DP brains of other P. And each of these gives some version of the correspondence. And also you might imagine that by putting brains in geometries other than flat space, you might find other examples of the correspondence. There's a little bit of a subtlety there, which is that the statement that the set of points surrounding the locus of points surrounding a point, equal distance from some point, this is R, is S5, doesn't depend on the fact that the geometry is exactly flat. It depends on the fact that the geometry is smooth on over distance scales of order the sizes that we're looking at. So indeed, if you put the three brains at a point, at any smooth point in any geometry, the set of points surrounding it is again an S5. And if you zoom in, if you do this argument that we did looking at low energy excitations, which means looking at just a neighborhood of the brain, it actually forgets about what space it's living in. But there's a very interesting way around this, which is to study D brains probing singularities. So if the geometry is singular, for example, if it's defined by some quotient, by say like R6 mod some discrete group gamma, then that acting by rotations around this point in R6, then indeed one can derive other examples of the correspondence with less symmetry, and in fact there are infinitely many examples of this kind. So it's important to keep in mind that this example that we're focusing on is just the tip of a very big garbage tip. I mean, tip of a very big collection of examples. Having said that, this is one of very many. Let's devote a little more effort to convincing ourselves that in fact this is true. So I want to spend a few minutes thinking about basic checks of ADS-CFT for the special case of n equals 4 super Yang-Mills. So over here, the first kind of check I want to talk about is symmetries. So over here, I'll put type 2b strings on ADS5 times S5. Let's put that in a box. And over here, I'll put n equals 4 super Yang-Mills. So let's think about what the symmetries are. So over here, there are some obvious symmetries, which are these isometries of this spacetime, which are, there's the isometries of ADS5, as I've already mentioned, are SO4, 2. I'll say a little more about that in a second. That's isometries of the ADS5 times SO6. SO6 is the isometry group of around S5, which is just the rotations of these coordinates transverse to the D3 brains. And similarly, here, there's the conformal group, which is SO4, 2, times SO6. And so let me make some comments about this SO4 comma 2. So this is the relativistic conformal group in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And it's useful to think of it as, well, so it contains the Poincaré group in 3 plus 1 dimensions as a subgroup. So this is rotations in space, Lorentz boosts, and I guess this is Lorentz group, and translations are in there too, and then it also includes dilatations, which is a fancy word for scale transformations, x mu goes to lambda, x mu, and then it also contains special conformal transformations, which I'm not going to say too much about, but they're called K, and they have a vector index, so there's 3 plus 1 of them. So this symmetry group you can show is the same as this symmetry group. And then there's this SO6, which from the point of view of this geometry is completely obvious. It's just rotations of this S5. And from the point of view of the N equals 4 theory, there are a few things I can say about it. First of all, something that I think you all know is that the N equals 4 Supring Mills has 6 adjoint scalar fields as part of its microscopic degrees of freedom. This is a familiar statement. So these are the coordinate, if you like, these are the coordinates of the 3-brain moving around in this transverse space. If there's a single 3-brain, then this isn't so mysterious. If there are n of them, it's a nice fact that they live in the adjoint of the SUN gauge group. And so this SO6 rotates the xi, I equals 1 to 6, in the six-dimensional vector representation. And it also is an R symmetry. Is this a familiar concept? So an R symmetry is a symmetry of the supersymmetric theory which acts on the supercharges. That is to say, there are some supercharges. I'll say a little more about that in a second. And there's 4 of them. And the supercharges are in the 4-dimensional representation of SO6, which is more familiar if you think about SO6 as it's a funny fact about low-dimensional Lie groups, that this SO6 is the same as SU4, more or less. And the supercharges are in the 4-dimensional representation. And so the fact that the supercharges transform under this group means that different components of the same multiplet of supersymmetry transform differently from each other, right? Because the way we generate the different components of the multiplet is by acting with the supercharges. And if the supercharges themselves have quantum numbers under this SO6, then the components will transform differently. Okay. So having said that, I guess I should also say that in addition to these isometries, there's also 32 supercharges preserved by this background. And those map to the 16 supercharges, ordinary supercharges of n equals 4 supering mills. That's what this 4 means. Right? That means that there's 4 spinners of supercharges, each of which has 4 components, 4 real components, and so altogether there are 16 supercharges of this theory. So that seems like a mismatch. But then there's also 16 things you might call superconformal charges, which are obtained by taking one of these supercharges and acting on it with one of these guys, with one of these special conformal transformations. And so these are independent generators, and these 32 objects map to these 32 objects. And there's some fancy name for the group that contains both this bosonic part and this fermionic part, which is some supergroup, which I'm not sure why it's useful to remember what that name is. And then finally, there's an SL2Z action on each of these theories, which is much, much more mysterious and interesting than any of these things. It acts on a certain combination of the moduli of the type 2B theory, which I'll call tau, which is, let's see, I'm going to get the normalization wrong. It's something like I over G string this is the string coupling, plus, let's say, C0 Ramond-Ramond. This is type 2B has a zero-form potential, which is a zero-form Ramond-Ramond potential. And combining these two objects in this way, there is an action of SL2Z, which acts in this way, A tau plus B over C tau plus D, where A, B, C, D are integers such that AD minus BC is 1. If you take a vacuum of type 2B with one value of G string in this Ramond-Ramond field and replace those with any one of these, the physics is the same. So this thing is called S-duality. And it's a very deep and remarkable fact about type 2B string theory. And note that in particular, one of these transformations is G string goes to minus, it goes to 1 over G string. There may be a 2 pi here, which maybe I haven't been careful about. So you see this takes weak coupling to strong coupling at fixed n. So there's quite a bit of evidence for this statement. Note that this is really a gauge symmetry. It's an equivalence of descriptions. There was already quite a bit of evidence for this statement before this. And it's also the case that in n equals 4 supering Mills, if we define a tau, which is I over Jiang Mills squared, I'm pretty sure there's definitely a pi here. Let's put a 2 pi there. Plus theta, where theta is the theta angle, that is the coefficient in the action multiplying the term f wedge f. I guess there's a 2 pi here. So trace f wedge f. The term in the action multiplying the Pontryagin density, that's what I mean by theta, then this thing also enjoys an SL2Z action, that is the n equals 4 supering Mills with some particular value of these constants is the same as the one with these replaced by any SL2Z image. And there's quite a bit of independent evidence for this statement. And so the fact that these dualities map to each other under this duality is evidence for both of them. Okay. So this was, how to say, so that is to say that the symmetries match. So now, having said that the symmetries match, we can ask, that was point one here. This is basic check number one is symmetries. Basic check number two is, having checked that the symmetries match, we should ask whether the representations of the symmetries that appear in the theories match also. So that is, the symmetry groups match, but do the representations of those groups that appear in the spectrum match? And here too, the answer of course is yes. And one important special case of that is the following claim, that at low energies, this statement of this duality is really a statement about type 2B strings. The truth of the duality really requires all of the power of string theory, and not just supergravity, but at low energies, that string theory reduces to type 2B supergravity, and a very special case of a special subset of the excitations of this theory are linearized supergravity perturbations. So that is little ripples of gravitational gravity waves or gravitino waves or whatever there is in the spectrum of supergravity. All linearized supergravity perturbations. We can explicitly we can explicitly match to some operators in the n equals 4 theory as follows. So remember the dictionary that we're trying to establish is that all fields in the bulk match to operators in the theory on the boundary. So here's an example of a supergravity field on ADS5 times S5. So type 2B supergravity, includes some list of massless 10-dimensional fields, including the metric, and there's a gravitino, and there's some Ramon-Ramon forms. And for each of those, which let me just call any one of those phi of x and y, so phi is some, you know, can be any one of those. Let's just forget about the spin indices for a second. Let's think about, I guess there's a dilaton. Let's think about the dilaton. It's a scalar in 10 dimensions. We can decompose the coordinates into x and y. X is a coordinate and is 5, and then y is a coordinate and is 5. And we can do Fourier decomposition. That is just, you know, decompose a mode on this phi sphere into five sphere spherical harmonics. Right? So that is, I can write this as some sum over some object which depends only on ADS 5. And it has some indices which are the indices that a five-dimensional spherical harmonic has, which it turns out are we can think of them as a collection of vector indices. This is an L. This is a sum over these sets of I1 through ILs. L is the spin. And these indices are symmetric. This tensor here is a symmetric tensor, a symmetric traceless tensor. And that's the condition for this to be an irreducible representation of SO6. And the actual spherical harmonic we can make, this is something you could also do on S2. It's maybe not the way it's always described, but it's the right way to do it. We can make just by thinking of the coordinates on the S5 as coordinates in the embedding R6. So that is y goes from 1 to 6, and then we restrict this thing, this function, to the unit sphere. That is sum of the yi's up to 6. I equals 1 to 6, yi squared is equal to 1. So I claim that this object here is a spherical harmonic on S5. So this is just that was just some group theory there. And I claim, so then this object here is then a field. This is a field, this T. It's a field in ADS 5. Right? It depends only on the coordinates of ADS 5. T I 1 through I L. And there's some multiplicity that comes from counting how many symmetric traceless indices there are, traceless tensors there are. And I promise I didn't do that on purpose. And notice that it's mass. So this object is massless in 10 dimensions. And so the mass of this object that we get by Kaluza-Klein decomposition, which that's what we're doing, by the way, is the mass of this object T as a field in 5 dimensions. It's 5D mass. Is something like L over big L. So that's because L is the radius of the sphere. Big L is the radius of the sphere, and L is its angular momentum. And that's basically just because when you take derivatives on the sphere, the derivatives hit each one of these L y's and give a single contribution of order 1 over L. So this, you know, this is a familiar formula. If you think about Kaluza-Klein decomposition on a circle, the eigenvalues of the Laplacian, which is the square of this, are an integer over the radius, all squared. And so I'm writing a twiddle because spheres are different from circles by some order 1 coefficients that I'm going to ignore here. And I claim that the operator, the n equals 4 operator to which this corresponds, is something very simple. It's just, let me call it O sub t, an operator that I can make that has the same quantum numbers. It lives on, there's a little bit of an abusive notation here. Let me call x with an underline the coordinates on ADS 5. So x with an underline is a coordinate on ADS 5. Never mind. I don't need to do that. Here. So x is a coordinate on ADS 5, and let me call x mu is a coordinate on just the Minkowski space on the boundary. And the operator that we need to make is just T, I1, through IL. And you won't be too surprised if I tell you that the thing that plays the role of these y's is the matrix X. Trace XI1 of X all the way up to XIL of X. So you see this object here. So these X's are these X's. These are adjoint fields. These are fields of transforming the adjoint of the n equals 4 Hadron group, and have this 6, that's this index that they have, the 6 index under this SO6, which transforms the same way as these YIs. And we take the trace to make a gauge invariant so that it's a physical operator. And you see we can contract these indices with exactly the same tensor structure that we had over here. Okay, so and notice the dimension of this operator. If we just use engineering dimensions, just each of these things is like a scalar field in 3+1 dimensions, which in free field theory, a scalar field in 3+1 dimensions has mass dimension 1. And so if we add up the mass dimensions here, ignoring the interactions, the fact that there can and in general will be anomalous dimensions, the dimension of this object is just L times as big as the dimension of a single one. And so you see this relation here is consistent with my earlier claim that delta times delta minus D for a scalar operator is going to be M squared L squared. So this is going to be exactly true. And if you squint, it says, you know, delta squared is of order M squared L squared, which is true here. Because you see M squared L squared is L, and delta is L. And if we keep, if one has enough, what is the word, fortitude, to keep track of the order 1 coefficients here, in fact, you can get the right exactly the right answer. Yes, please. Is it the same T? It's not quite the same T, because you see this T is really a field on ADS5, and this thing is some coefficient. It has the same index structure. So really the thing I'm matching is, but okay, good. The thing I'm matching is fields in ADS5 with operators in the N equals 4 theory. And so I say this: the field with this many indices matches to the operator where I can track the field with this that transforms in this representation of SO6 corresponds to the operator where I can track those x's with the tensor that transforms in the same representation. Good. Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. And so actually, yes, please.
Are those capital X there the scalar field?
Yes. Yeah, the adjoint scalar fields in the N equals 4 theory. Right. Yeah, let me. It has some AB index where A and B go from 1 to N, and this I goes from 1 to 6. And this X lives in Minkowski space. Right. Yeah. Okay, so that makes it look much more horrible. Okay, and then so actually, this from this one statement, it turns out that we can get this. One can derive this whole claim about all of the linearized supergravity perturbations because this symmetry group is so big. In fact, but just by acting with the supercharges on this statement, you can derive all the rest of them. And in this way, you can derive very intimidating tables of how multiplicities of which representations appear on the both hand side of the duality, and intimidate your doubters into submission. But I will not subject you to this. You'll be happy to hear. Okay, but there's something a little bit unsatisfying about what I've told you here, which is that I guess there are two aspects of it. One is that here I'm only talking about the linearized supergravity perturbations, and whereas we think that string theory has other excitations in it, whose energies are of order the string mass scale, and related to that, all of these operators that we construct in the N equals 4 theory are very special. They're very special in the sense that when we do this procedure of constructing other operators by acting on them with the supercharges, they live in short multiplets of the supersymmetry. That is to say, some of these supercharges annihilate these states. That is, you don't get a different, so when acting with some of the Q's on these O's, sometimes you get 0. And so the way you fill out the representation is by exactly this procedure. And so if some of them give 0, that means that the representation is smaller. That's what I mean by a short multiplet. And this property, by the way, is called BPS. And it's a very powerful thing because the supersymmetry algebra for these things then constrains the interactions of these operators. And in fact, it constrains them so much that you can compute the three-point functions of these operators. So this is check number three. Three-point functions of these BPS operators. You can compute them in the n equals 4 theory and just in the free field theory. And you can compute them in the supergravity theory using the prescription that we'll start getting to later today. They match. They match exactly. And notice that one was a calculation at lambda equals 0. Let's call it C, the three-point function C. C at lambda equals 0, and it turns out to be the same at lambda equals infinity. And the fact that it's independent of lambda is a consequence of this property. So this is a very special thing. But of course, it's a check that one had to do. If it didn't work, then the duality couldn't have been true. But it begs the question, well, what about all the other operators? Not all of the operators in the n equals 4 theory live in short multiplets of the supersymmetry algebra. So in particular, here we contracted these x's in a very particular way. In particular, there's no trace part here. I said that this tensor was symmetric and traceless. A more general operator, of the n equals 4 superiority nils of this gauge theory looks something like this. It looks like O of x is something like, so this is somewhat more general. It's a trace, again, a trace of a bunch of things. And maybe there's some x's multiplied by matrix multiplication. I should have said these indices here I'm multiplying by matrix multiplication. And then maybe there's a derivative of x. And then maybe there's a y, where y is one of the other, let's say, x is x1, and y is x2, and so on. And then maybe there's an f mu nu, which is the field strength of the Yang-Mills gauge theory. And then maybe there's some more x's, and then maybe there's a y. So this is a more general operator. And this thing is not in general, unless I made some bad choices here, and is not in general BPS. It's not annihilated by any of the supercharges. But on the other hand, I told you that using these, in fact, so the sum here I can replace by BPS operators. Sometimes they're also called chiral. So on the other hand, I've said that we ran out of supergravity perturbations with just from the list of short multiplets, and so this thing is not BPS, and so in general its dimension, its scaling dimension will depend on lambda, and its correlation functions will depend on lambda. By lambda I mean the Itauf coupling, this parameter that interpolates for us between weak coupling, where this description is simple, and strong coupling, where this description is simple. Suppose that there are j objects in this list of things. Naively, it's free. It's free scaling dimension when the matrices don't interact with each other. There's just this engineering dimension. We just have to count how many things appear there. It's just j. But in general, it will depend on lambda. And so for a hint as to who in the string theory these operators can be, is there a question? Where are we going? Well, where are we going? So we're doing this basic check of ADS-CFT. So far, we talked about what the symmetries of both sides are. Then we talked about, generally now we're trying to talk about which representations of those symmetries appear in type 2B string theory and especially in S5 and in the n equals 4 superring nils. We've matched a large subset of those things that appear, that is BPS operators in the n equals 4 theory correspond to linearized supergravity perturbations. But then there's more stuff over here, and we're trying to figure out what that is over here. Okay? A hint as to the identity of what that more stuff is the following observation. Well, so notice taking the trace of a product of matrices is a cyclic thing. That is, this operator is also equal to trace of, let's see, which way do I want to go? Well, I can put this y over here, y, x, 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 d mu, x, y, f mu, and then two x's. Right, so that is, it's the same if I put this y over here and all, everybody shifts a little bit to the left. You see it has the structure of a closed loop. Right? And this, and there's a, the position of a given object inside that loop is like a coordinate along a one-dimensional space, which has the topology of a circle because of the cyclicity of the trace. And so this object has the structure of a closed string. And this is not a coincidence. So these excitations correspond to, by the duality to closed string excitations, in at least in some special cases, one can make a very precise match between the properties of these operators and the properties of type 2B strings in ADS5 and SS5, and this is a subject that I believe Pedro will talk about in quite a bit more detail next week. So, but there's one general lesson that I'd like to draw from this about attempts to generalize this duality, which is the following. That was one entry in our table, and then the next entry in our table is many operators in the quantum field theory, like the ones like those. So in particular, anything that's not BPS corresponds by the duality to string states, excited string states. Excited closed string states. Right, type 2B string theory in ADS5 times S5 is a theory of closed strings. And notice whereas the mass of these supergravity modes is of order 1 over L ADS squared, right? That's just the same equation as this, where this L is L ADS. I just want to emphasize that that's what it is. The radius of curvature of ADS. And so this means, according to this dictionary, this equation that I keep using and I hope to derive later today, means that this corresponds to an operator. The dimension of an operator in the Nichols 4 theory corresponding to a supergravity mode is of order n to the 0, lambda to the 0. And here I'm using, right, okay, so that is to say it's a number of order 1, like L, so that you see this thing does not scale either with n, nor does it scale with the Itauf coupling. It's just some number, which, yes? Okay.
Basically, you're saying that that structure over there is somehow topology of a circle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's only because of the simplicity of the threads that you're saying that.
Well, if you think about this number of operators appearing here as large, then if you squint at it, it becomes continuous, right? There's a continual limit that you can take. And this is it's not a joke, as Pedro will definitely convince you.
Yeah, well, it's just surprising at first.
Okay, yeah. No, it's the fact that you can... that one can make this statement very precise is also surprising and very remarkable. Good. But I don't want to spend more time on it because Pedro will. But I do want to extract this general lesson. On the other hand, the mass of a string state, right? That by an excited string state means that there's oscillator modes rippling on the string, and so as hopefully you remember from the quantization of strings, at least in flat space, these objects have a mass that goes like 1 over alpha prime. Right, that is to say that an excitation of some oscillator mode on the world sheet costs an energy which goes like 1 over, which goes like the string mass. That is, the string has a tension which is 1 over alpha prime. So if it wiggles, it has this energy. Yeah, on Friday, we derived a relationship between various quantities that appear here, which said the following, that the string scale in ADS-510's S5 is related to other parameters by this relation. It's square root of lambda, square root of the ATIF coupling, over the ADS radius squared. So I wrote this in the form L ADS to the fourth. L ADS to the fourth is equal to lambda alpha prime squared. Right, this was the equation I wrote before, and so by the laws of algebra, this is also true. And this translating into properties of the anomalous dimension of those operators, it says that the dimension of an operator like this one, as a function of n and the ATIF coupling, had better go like, well, it still goes like n to the zero, but it had better go like lambda to the 1/4, right? That's the dimension is more or less the square root of the mass, and so it goes like lambda to the 1/4. And the LADS gets stripped off by this formula. So that is to say that the claim of the duality, if the duality is true, this operator, which has a dimension, which is just some number, right, j, which j a priori doesn't depend on any of the other parameters, it doesn't depend on lambda or n, this operator, as we take the theory to strong coupling, had better go to infinity. As we take lambda to infinity, it had better go to infinity like this particular power. That's a claim of the duality, which in fact has been verified. Maybe not for an arbitrary operator, but for a very large class of operators like this, using this picture I was describing. This says that there's a hierarchy in the list of dimensions of operators in a theory that has a simple gravity dual. So that is, a simple gravity dual, that is, in order to have a quantum field theory, which is described by a gravity theory with just a few fields and not some gigantic list of fields that create excited stringy states, it's necessary that the spectrum of dimensions looks something like this. So there's down here, there's some simple gravity modes, like these supergravity modes here that we like, whose dimensions go like n to the 0, lambda to the 0, just order 1 dimensions. So this is at large lambda and large n, where we think that we can have a simple classical theory of gravity. All the way up here, there should be the states that correspond to strings, string excitations, whose dimensions go like lambda to the 1/4 times n to the 0. And then there can be some other states all the way up here, which are d-brain excitations. If I plug in the mass of a D brain, well, that goes like 1 over G string alpha prime, something like that. I put the alpha prime just to make the right dimensions. So remember the tension of it. I'm going to get the power wrong. Here, let's. I guess it's the mass. The mass goes like 1 over G string. This is if I have a brain wrapped on some cycle, and some, say I wrap a D5 brain on the S5, there's some other powers here, which I'm going to ignore, but the important thing is that there's a 1 over G string, and that means that the dimension of the corresponding operator has an extra power of n, right? 1 over G string is n, and so this is n to some power bigger than 1 times lambda to some power. And so all the way up here, there can be things whose dimension goes like n times lambda to some power, which depends on more details than I've specified here. Okay, and so this spectrum of dimensions is a necessary condition to have a simple gravity dual. And notice that there are two independent things that are happening here. One is taking n large makes the bulk theory classical. It makes the bulk theory classical because, you know, if you like, there's a big n squared in front of the action, but it doesn't make it into supergravity. It's still string theory. So this is like, if you like, it's classical string theory, whereas lambda large here is what makes these string excitations very heavy. And so this means the string states decouple. And so we just get just some gravity theory, which if n is small is some quantum gravity theory, but without strings. And then both lambda and n large means that you can forget about the fact that it's a string theory, and you can treat it classically. OK, but the fact that when you take this coupling large, you get this hierarchy in dimensions is something that maybe is special to the n equals 4 theory and theories like it. And in general, we don't know. So there's no first principles derivation of you know, give me some quantum field theory. I can't tell you whether this will happen or not. And this is really the condition to have a simple gravity dual. All right. Okay, so this marks the end of the part of the discussion where there's lots of string theory, at least this part of the discussion. And now I want to return to developing the general dictionary, and in particular I want to derive the relation I just erased. I want to derive this relationship between masses of fields in the bulk and dimensions of operators, which I've been using over and over again. Are there any questions? I said lots of confusing things just now. There really should be questions. Are we going to hoof? You'll be tested on it, yes. I'm sorry, what do you mean use? I don't know. I mean, I use this all the time. I'm going to talk about, I'm going to continue talking about holographic duality in some situation where I imagine I have some simple gravity theory living in some with some asymptotic geometry, with some time-like boundary, and the basic question I'm going to ask is what physics can I extract from this, right? Assuming that it describes some dual field theory, and a question that you should have in mind is, well, what does this assumption that the gravity theory is simple, by which I mean that there's just a few fields in the bulk, so there's like there's the metric, and there's maybe some scalar field, and maybe just a couple of other things. What does this assumption about the simpleness of the gravity theory imply about the field theory dual? And how special is that? And I'm telling you that this is what it means. So it's, I think, a very important point to keep in mind. Yeah? Here, yeah, yes. Yes. Right, so this x is just is a point in space-time. And, yeah, I should have said this is a little x. Right. And each of those are at the same point. Yeah.
Can we see non-local operators?
Indeed, we can. Well, a simple statement is that Wilson loops are strings. That's in fact the most direct way to see the connection with string theory. But maybe Pedro will also say more about that. he's gonna compute some Wilson loops. And so he'll have to explain more about them. Yeah, so the answer is yes, but not now. Good. So the next thing I want to do is build up some technical machinery which first of all, we'll confirm once and for all this picture that the radial direction is the RG scale, and that the boundary has to do with the ultraviolet. And secondly, we'll derive this relationship between the mass of the bulk field and the dimension. So really the thing that I'm heading towards is the answer to this question. And so the basic equality that we've already seen that allows us to calculate is the statement that the partition function of the quantum field theory as a function of sources for say local operators, which I'll call phi naught, is by which I mean e to the minus integral phi naught O, and maybe there's some sum over operators in the quantum field theory. And maybe let's think about the particular case of CFT. So just for argument, we'll think about the special case of perturbing a conformal fixed point. And so this is the thing we'd like to be able to compute. This O is some operator in CFT, and really, if you like, you can think of there's some sum over operators there. And so using this, we can differentiate it, functionally differentiating this vector finite, we can compute arbitrary correlation functions of these local operators. And the basic statement of the dictionary is that when the bulk theory is classical in this large n limit, that this thing is dominated by some saddle point, which is of the form, so there's some big n squared up front, which makes the saddle point well peaked, and then there's some bulk action in here, which we should evaluate on a configuration of phi, which I'm going to underline this. So I'll say what that means in a second, such that phi near the boundary is phi naught. So this phi naught is that phi naught. And what I mean by this underline is phi with the underline solves the bulk equations of motion. That is ds d phi evaluated at phi equals phi underline is equal to 0. So sorry, di d phi. Di bulk d phi. So this I, by the way, is just it differs from the usual classical action by pulling out this factor of n squared, just for convenience. And okay, and so this equation here is in quotes. We're going to fix that hopefully now. And what else is not explained here? Okay. There's a hanging parenthesis. Oh my god. Okay. Right. So the stuff in here is the argument of the bulk action, right? Where this bulk action is a functional of fields in the bulk. We're evaluating on a particular solution. The underline means that it's a solution which satisfies this boundary condition. Okay. The parentheses are all right now, yeah? Okay. And so, and the fact that it's e to the minus the action is just the statement that it's a saddle point of some integral that we don't really know what it is. All we know is the saddle point. Okay, now let's refine this a little bit. So if we really wanted to compute this, there's a fact that we have to confront, which is that recall when we were counting degrees of freedom. There's, you know, quantum field theory has infinitely many degrees of freedom because they're distributed, you know, if you put it on infinite space, they're distributed over this infinite space, and also because there are degrees of freedom at every point, right? And so they're even in some finite region, there are infinitely many points. And so there are really short distance divergences in the number of degrees of freedom. And so you won't be too surprised if I tell you that, of course, there are also going to be short distance divergences in trying to compute some observable like this. And anticipating that there will be short distance divergences also in the bulk calculation, let's cut off the space-time. So this is going to be anticipating UV divergences, a holographic version of the ultraviolet cutoff is to cut off the space-time so that z is restricted to be bigger than epsilon. So remember that the ADS metric is. I'm going to write it over here and not erase it. So let's just think about ADS for now. So the ADS metric is L squared over Z squared times DZ squared plus flat space. Okay, and so the boundary is that Z goes to 0. That's where the size of the Minkowski space is blown up. And but I'm going to cut it off so that you never get to the boundary. Here's this picture again. So here's the real, here's Z equals infinity. Instead, we stop at Z equals epsilon. Okay. And we're going to set the boundary conditions there. So my first modification of this equation is, instead of setting boundary conditions at z equals 0, I'm going to put the boundary conditions at z equals epsilon. There's going to be another modification. So this is anticipating that UV divergences. All right. And so now, for definiteness, here I've been, you know, I could have been talking about fields of any spin here and just suppressing the indices. But for definiteness, let's talk about a scalar field. So a simple example, let's think about a scalar in the bulk. And when I write metrics, you should. So let me define the components of the metric in this way. So A is some index that runs from, runs over the space-time indices, and then also Z. Let me pick the simplest action I can imagine, which is this n squared times I is I'm going to call S, and let me pick the action to be S of phi. So there's other terms in the action besides the one for the scalar field, but the action for phi is something like minus k over 2, k is some constant, integral over the bulk, integral over d plus 1 dimensions, square root of g to make the measure covariant, and it has to have a kinetic term. So there's a gab, d dx a of phi, d dx b of phi. It has a kinetic term, and let's say it has a mass term, and let's say it has some self-interaction term. And then there can be more terms. So this is a pretty general class of possible actions for a scalar field. And it's coordinate invariant because of, I contracted all the indices with the metric, and I put the square root of g there in the measure. All right, so this is okay? This isn't too shocking, I hope. All right, now it's going to be useful to, and I guess I should say, This thing here is some coupling constant, which you should imagine that this k is proportional to n squared. It's some coupling constant, which I'm going to assume that it's proportional to n squared. At least it's proportional to n to some positive power. So that phi is a classical field, so that we can treat phi as a classical field. And some facts about the geometry that will be useful. The square root of g, if we evaluate it in ADS, what I mean by square root of g is square root of the absolute value of the determinant of G, of this matrix G, which, plugging this in, you can convince yourself that it's L over Z to the some power, which I think is D plus 1. Is that right? It's the determinant of a 5 by 5, a D plus 1 by D plus 1 matrix, each of whose components, whose diagonal components are H, L squared over Z squared. And then we have to take the square root, so I think that's right. And then the inverse metric that appears here is just z squared over L squared. We invert that, and then delta AB. And I guess I should say, since I already wrote this minus sign here, I said that the partition function is e to the minus the action. I guess I'm assuming, at least for now, that we're in Euclidean space, and so I can write delta here rather than some kind of Minkowski thing. And so now let's study the fluctuations of this field about some solution of the equations of motion. Right, so that is to say, in this classical limit, the partition function is dominated by some saddle point when there are no sources. With some particular value of the sources, the action is dominated by some saddle point. By wiggling the sources, we can study the fluctuations around that saddle point. An example of a saddle point that we can consider, so that is to say the classical background about which we'll expand, is just ADS. So I've in fact already assumed that in the stuff I was writing over here. It's just ADS. And I need to tell you what the background for phi is. Let's just say phi equals 0. So I'm assuming that the coefficients here are such that phi equals 0 is a solution of the equations of motion, which will be true if these coefficients are positive. And it'll be stable in that case, too. Okay, so let's expand around the solution. And the reason to do that is, remember, this is a solution which preserves the conformal symmetry of the whatever the conformal field theory is dual to this. And so recall, then, that we can compute, then, the two-point functions of this operator O to which phi corresponds in the CFT vacuum by differentiating with respect to phi naught twice the log of z at phi naught equals 0. Okay, so that is to say, if we if we want to compute the two-point function of this operator in the CFT vacuum, we compute the partition function as a function of this perturbation. But then we only need to know the second-order infinitesimal behavior of this around the place where the perturbation is zero. And so really, we can think of phi as a perturbation. And in that case, the things in here that go like phi cubed, we can just ignore. So for purposes of computing this two-point function, we only need things to second order and phi naught, and this thing will not appear. And so for the purposes of the next part of the discussion, we can ignore the self-interactions of phi, which makes our lives much simpler because we can actually solve linear wave equations. Okay, so this means, because of this, we're going to ignore interactions. I won't write that. All right, so the first step is to integrate by parts. So we have we have this quadratic functional phi, and it's useful to integrate by parts to rewrite that as minus fancy k over 2. Okay, there's two terms. So there's a bulk term, which is integral over the bulk, square root of g. Integral over the bulk, square root of g, phi minus Laplacian plus m squared phi. Right, so here all I did was integrate by parts. You take one of these derivatives and put it on the other one. But notice that because these guys depend on space, and particularly they depend on the radial coordinate of ADS, when I put this derivative over there, I get the Laplacian. By the way, the Laplacian on phi on a scalar is just 1 over square root of g dA gAB dB phi square root of g. If you like, this is a definition of the Laplacian, which makes this equation true. And notice, by the way, this is an expression for the Laplacian, which one didn't need to write any Christoffel symbols to write this. You should never write Christoffel symbols, ever. There's just no reason ever to ever write them. This is an important thing to keep in mind. The people who encourage you to, figure out what the components of the Christoffel symbols are, they should, it's a crime against humanity. All right. So but this equation is not done because there's a boundary term. When we integrate by parts, there's another bit, which is, let's see, where is it? Minus? How can it be minus? All right, I'm a little confused about the sign, but let me trust my notes. Integral over the boundary of ADS of something with only one derivative in it, which is it's integral over just, so this thing is at z equals epsilon, the boundary is at z equals epsilon. It's an integral over only d dimensions. There's a square root of the metric on the boundary. Let me call it gamma. And, let me call it square. No, sorry. It's square, it's really square root of g. And then there's g, just z times zb. This is the a equals z component of the metric. That's because the boundary is perpendicular to the z direction. And then phi dB phi. OK, so here we just integrated by parts. But we learned two things from it. From this expression, we learn, I think it's right, first of all, that the equation of motion for small fluctuations of phi is the wave equation, right? You're not too surprised by that statement. So that is phi, which solves the equation of motion, should satisfy this bulk wave equation. So the underline means that it's a solution. And secondly, if phi solves the wave equation, if phi solves the wave equation, then the on-shell action, which is, by the way, the thing that we want here, the action evaluated on this solution, remember it's z, remember, is equal to e to the minus this on-shell action. This is the desideratum of this calculation. Then it's just the boundary term. Right? The on-shell action is just the boundary term because if phi solves the equations of motion, then this bit vanishes and all that's left is this. Okay. How are we doing? Can I keep going for? Is that a no? Five minutes. I want to get to this relation I promised. We're almost there. So now let's think about the wave equation a little more. The problem we're studying, just this wave equation in planar ADS, in ADS where the slices of fixed radial coordinate are just Minkowski space, it has this translation invariance, right? And if you solve a problem with translation invariance, nearly always it's best to take advantage of that by going to Fourier space. And so, okay, the subject here is the wave equation in ADS. And translation invariance says that we should, that is x mu goes to x mu plus a constant, says that we should go to Fourier space. And so let's think about our field, which in general is a function of z and x mu, as let's make an ansatz for it, as e to the I k mu x mu times some function, which let me call it f sub k, of that depends only on z. And so by, okay, right. And so k is just some numbers. And if you like, we could write a general such expression as an integral over, you know, some sum of these Fourier modes, sum over k, right, by the Fourier theorem. But because the equation we're solving is linear, we can do it one mode at a time and then add them up at the end. Okay, so that's what I'll do. And so plugging this into the wave equation, this is star is the wave equation. What is this? This is, there's the terms where the derivatives, so we need to figure out what this Laplacian phi is. There's the terms where the derivatives are along the spatial directions, in which case, all this stuff in here, this stuff only depends on z, right? The square root of g times the g inverse only depends on z. Doesn't depend on x, and so if these derivatives act along the spatial directions, we can just forget about all that junk in there. It just comes out, and so the bit that's left is just g mu nu, k mu k nu, from the spatial directions. Because when the derivatives hit the only thing that depends on x is this thing, and so we just pull down powers of minus I k or plus I k. I guess this is minus star. No, sorry. Right. It's minus this, and then there's two factors of I from here. And so this is the red sign. And then there's finally, the metric is diagonal, so we only need to think about when both of the indices are along space, or when both of the indices are along the z-coordinate. And so when both of the indices are along the z-coordinate, we need to keep those things in there. And we'll keep the minus sign, and what's left is 1 over square root of g, ddz of square root of g, gzz times f. I'm going to put the f at the end. And then there's a dz. And then finally, there's plus m squared. Okay. And I guess I also divided by the Fourier kernel. Okay, so you should check my expression. I think I got it right. And so this was actually for a metric where the metric here was some general thing. Let's plug in the behavior in ADS. This is 1 over L squared, Z squared, K squared means K mu, minus 1 over square root of Z, 1 over square root of G is Z to the D plus 1, DDZ, z to the minus d plus 1, there's an extra z squared from here, dz, and then plus m squared l squared, f sub k of z. All right, so now we're almost there. So now, if you ignore think about k equals 0. So ignore this term for a minute. Notice that the powers of z here are such that, so there's z to the d here, and then there's z to the minus d here. And then there's a plus 1 here and a plus 1 here. So the dimensions of this, the scaling behavior of this object here, this radial bit of the Laplacian in ADS, under z goes to lambda z, is it's first of all, it scales, and it scales like lambda to the 0, right? Because there's d plus 1 minus 1 minus d plus 1 minus 1 is equal to 0 powers of z here. And so this thing scales like lambda to the 0, and this thing scales like lambda to the 0. And so if we ignore this term, this equation is of a Bernoulli form, right? That's the word for it, right? When the differential operator scales like the parameter, the independent variable to the zeroth power, it means that there's power law solutions. If you plug in, let's make an ansatz for, if we plug in fk of z is z to the delta, it's not a coincidence that I'm calling it a delta, then and ignore this term, then we'll find a solution of this equation. So let's plug it in general. We'll get the equation says k squared z to the 2 plus delta minus, right, I'm going to skip a step. You have to check this yourself. Take these derivatives. Minus delta minus d plus m squared l squared all times, let's see, where does it go? Here, let me pull that factor out. All times z to the delta equals 0. And so you see, for small z, so if we can ignore this term, then there will be a solution by choosing delta in a way that sets this to 0. And we can ignore this term at small z. So this power law behavior is ruined by this annoying momentum dependence. But when z goes to 0, namely near the boundary, this term goes away. And so that is to say that the behavior of the solution to this differential equation near the boundary is a power law with a dimension delta determined by this relation. And I guess this is where we should stop. But you see, fk of z near the boundary, near goes to 0, z goes to 0, behaves like z to the delta with delta minus d equals m squared l squared, which is the relation that we were trying to find. I still need to convince you that this power delta that appears here is related to the dimension. We'll do that tomorrow. Okay?